very much for inviting me here. It's very nice to be here. So today I'm going to talk about loops in ADS from conformal field theories. And mostly what I'm going to say is based on on this paper that I wrote with Ofer Aroni, Fernando Aldai, and Eric Permutter. So I would like to give you a bit of motivation of what we have done and why. So what we have done, we have started the computation of amplitudes in ADS spaces. And on the other hand, we studied correlation function in conformal field theories at large n. So why do we want to study these two objects? First of all, because it's one of the motivations is to understand the structure of amplitudes in curved space-time. And doing this kind of computation, which may seem a bit obvious if we compare with the flat space computation, but actually these kind of amplitudes are pretty difficult to access with usual Feynman diagram techniques. And actually also the tree level is pretty hard. And on the other hand, studying this kind of correlation function is useful to understand better the dynamics of holographic CFTs beyond the leading order, where with leading order I mean 1 over n squared. Of course, these two objects should be related to through ADS CFT correspondence. That's why we can try to study these two objects in the same framework, more or less. Okay. So to be more specific, what I'm going to discuss, amplitude in ADS and the Meyllin representation of this kind of amplitude. So here you see the decomposition of an amplitude or a four-point function in terms of this kind of graphs. So you see this is the tree level. This is just the contact diagram. And then you see the one-loop diagrams. So this is all in one channel. As you see, there is only one of these. So you have to think of all the other two channels. And in order to study correlation functions, we are going to use the bootstrap approach. And mostly, actually, the whole talk is based on some analytical bootstrap approach. And then the aim is to try to connect these two different approaches and see why and how these two objects are connected. In principle, they may not be connected straightforwardly, but we will see that in the examples that I'm going to discuss, they are pretty much related. Okay, so the plan of the talk, I will start by reviewing the problem at order 1 over n squared. This problem was already solved, but in order to fix a bit the convention and to be all on the same place, I'm going to describe the 1 over n squared. Then I'm going to study the crossing equation at order 1 over n to the 4, which is the order in which I'm going to work for 3/4 of my talk. And then from the CFT point of view, I'm going to show you how it is possible using an expansion in inverse powers of the spin to reconstruct the anomalous dimension at order 1 over n squared, also for finite spin. So I'm kind of resuming this spin expansion, how to reconstruct this anomalous dimension. On the other hand, for the amplitude side, I'm going to discuss how to reconstruct the polar part of the Meyllin amplitude from the leading order data. So when I'm saying reconstruct the polar part, I order again 1 over n to the 4. And again, also in this kind of setting, I'm going to describe how to compute the anomalous dimension starting from the amplitude. And then I will end with some open problems and a bit of discussion. OK, let me start with some generalities and the settings in which we have been working. So we consider a four-point function of a generic CFT in the dimension and with large n expansion and a large mass gap. So if we take the operator product expansion of this of a single trace operator with dimension delta, you see that in this operator product expansion, there is trivially the identity operator, then the operator itself, then the stress tensor, Then there are double trace operator of this form, so that I will denote with OO and L, where N is this parameter here and L is this one, and then all the double trace made by with the stress tensor. In my talk, I'm going to restrict to this situation in which I'm not going to consider the operator O itself. We can say that there is a Z2 symmetry and we are just not going to talk about the single trace. Also, I'm ignoring the presence of the stress tensor, even if, as we maybe all know, that in any CFT, the stress tensor is present. But for the discussion, my discussion will be consistent, also ignoring the stress tensor. Towards the end of the talk, I'm going to say something about that. So also, these kind of operators are not present. So in the simplest setting, I can consider the identity operator and this kind of double trace. Actually, this setting is consistent because in order for crossing to be satisfied, the presence of double trace operator the double trace operator has to be there. So I cannot avoid talking about double trace operator, but I can ignore the presence of the stress tensor, and we will see in a second why. Then in principle, you can say, okay, but there can be also quadruple trace, triple trace, higher trace. And that's correct, of course, they appear, but they don't appear at order 1 over n to the 4. So we can safely ignore them at this order. And of course, triple trace and so on, they are again forbidden by this D2 symmetry. Okay, so just as a small summary on the method that I'm going to use. So we start with the four-point function. Then we know that in conformal field theories, four-point functions are dictated by conformal symmetry to be of this form, where this G is just a function of the cross ratios, where U and V are just the cross ratios. Okay, I can just write it for you, just in case you're wondering. Can I write here? Okay. So it's just a combination of space-time positions. Okay, so this is just U and V. And then there is this part which depends only on the dimension of this operator. Yes?
So can you go back a little bit to the last slide?
Sure.
What do you mean by the last mass gap? Can you explain a little bit?
Sorry, I didn't hear you. At the mass gap, what does it mean? Like, it means that I'm not considering essentially this single trace operator. So that there is a large mass gap between the first operator and the other operator appearing in the OPE.
You mean for the primary operators?
Yeah. So here I'm writing essentially all the primes, but of course there are also all the descendants because I'm going to discuss about, I'm going to take the contribution of all the primaries and all the descendants. So maybe you will see in a second what I'm going to discuss exactly. But yeah, with this I mean just that. Let me maybe just specify that I'm taking four primary operators. So this operator has to be primary. And this is the four-point function, which depends only on these cross ratios here. And then actually we can take the operator product expansion of these two guys and these two guys, as it shows here. And we can write all the operators appearing in the OPE of O at position x1 and x2, and the operator appearing at position x3 and x4. And this is all the intermediate operator, which are the ones that were in the previous slide. But we can also take the operator product expansion of x2 and x3 and x1 and x4. And of course, the composition should be the same. And this is what essentially this picture is saying. And if we want to write this kind this kind of picture in equation, this is just this formula here. So these factors, v to the delta, u to the delta, just come from this factor here, and this GUV goes into GVU. This is nothing but when you take this definition here, exchanging position 1 with position 3. So this is what I'm going to refer when I say crossing equation. It means just this relation here. Again, delta is the dimension of this operator here, so of the external operator. And also when I'm going to say external, I always mean the operator on the four-point function. When I say intermediate, it's always this operator which is exchanged between the two external ones. Okay. Now, on the other hand, we can decompose this four-point function in blocks. And the decomposition, I can write the decomposition in this way. So this one is the contribution of the identity operator. I normalize everything in such a way that this is just one. And this is, in the setting in which I'm working, is the contribution of all the primary and descendants appearing in the OP. So this n is exactly the same n that was labeling the double trace operators. And this delta is the dimension of these operators. And L is the spin of this intermediate operator. So this A and L are essentially the three-point function square and are the coefficient appearing in these vertices here. And this G, delta N, L, UV are the conformal blocks. And they are function of the cross ratios U and V. OK, now the whole idea is to expand this object in for large N. And we are going to expand both the four-point function and the dimension and the three-point couplings. So as you can see, the dimension, of course, leading order, as we saw before, is just the bare dimension of the fields. So it's just twice the dimension of the external operators plus 2n, which labels again the intermediate operator, plus L. And then there is the full tower of correction at large n. And the aim, essentially, of this talk is to discuss this object here, so gamma n L2. And of course, crossing has to be satisfied at each order in n. I will briefly review how to find a connection between this object at the leading order and also at 1 over n squared. So let's start with the leading order, which is very easy. So we can just compute this four-point function. The leading order is pretty easy. We can just do some weak contraction, and we obtain this four-point function, which correspond to this exchange, to these disconnected diagrams. We can decompose this four-point function in conformal blocks. It's pretty easy. You can just take the formula that I showed you before, and you can just see that the dimension has to be 2 delta plus 1 plus L. And by doing an expansion, you can read off this A and L 0. So let's say that we have both this object, delta 0 and A 0. You can just compute by knowing the 0 order. OK, this is pretty easy. Now I'm going to discuss how to extract the G1, gamma 1, and A1, which has already been done in 2009 by these guys. OK, let's start by expand the conformal partial wave, which is the conformal block decomposition. I just I've written this down again just to be specific and more concrete. So you can take this delta plus delta 0 plus delta 1 over n square, and you just expand. And in the expansion, you get this object here. So you can notice that there is a log u, which comes from the expansion of this term here. And there is an explicit dependent on this delta plus n as being the exponent of u here. Then there is a1 appearing and this combination of a0 gamma 1. OK, now let me make a small comment that will be crucial for the rest of the talk. So this is a generic property of conformal blocks. So if we take the small u limit, this is pretty explicit from this formula here. So you see, first of all, that as I said, there is a kind of the expansion is an expansion in powers of u, and also that there is a log u dependence here. And the log u is just a first order because, as I said, this just comes from the expansion of u to the delta. And if we take the small v limit of a single conformal block, we just get this kind of behavior where this a tilde and b tilde are just function which don't contain any log B. But as we see, there is a log B dependence for V going to zero for a single conformal block. So if we are going to see a divergence in V, this is going to come from a single conformal block or from a finite sum of conformal blocks, which for me is more or less the same for the moment. Okay, this has to be remembered, especially for the second part of the talk. In this case, we can study, so for now in this case, we are interested in A1 and gamma 1. And we can study the divergent terms, and divergence meaning log U, log V, log V, and so on, all the possible combination. And using crossing, it is possible to find this set of solutions. And very nicely, you can already maybe guess that since there is a log U, only a log U, not any higher power of log U, by crossing, there should also be only log V, or at least log U, log V. There cannot be higher power of log V. So this means that these gamma 1 and A1 are different from 0 only for a finite range of spin, because log U, log V has to be reproduced by a finite number of blocks. And this is pretty important, and we will see that what's the difference compared to the next order. And actually, also a nice relation between gamma 1 and A1 has been found by these guys and then proved later, that there is a relation between essentially A1 is more or less the derivative with respect to little n of A0. Oh, actually, it is the derivative of A0 gamma 1. So when you know gamma, you essentially know also A, by using this very nice formula. Notice that, of course, we need to know all the gamma n because we need to take the derivative with respect to n. So if you have some gammas, you are not able to reconstruct A0. Sorry, A1. Okay.
Sorry.
Yes?
Just a comment.
Sure.
You cannot conclude that it's a finite number. You can say that with a finite number, it's enough.
Yes, but you can. So, if you think that the dependence with the spin is not exponential or some different thing, this is the only way of. So, if you say that the anomalous dimension for large spin has to go like 1 over the spin to some power, that's the only way.
Sorry, what's the only way?
Then so if you have gamma, imagine that we say that you need all the gamma and L1 are different from 0. Then there should be a large spin decomposition also of this gamma 1. And if you assume that this spin decomposition is like a coefficient over L to some power, then this is the only way of kind of reproducing this log U, log V term. So you need to have only a finite number of them to be different from zero, because you cannot have this kind of behavior 1 over L to some power. Because otherwise you will need an infinite sum. So you should have an infinite sum of conformal blocks, and this will give a term which is like log square V. And log square V is not allowed by crossing, because if you have a log square V, you should also have a log square U.
So you say that with the known asymptotics that we know these objects have at large spin, if you were to compute the tails that you drop, you will get extra powers of logs?
Log square V.
That's impossible. We do know that there are theories which contain any spin and any n. I mean, it's not like in a physical theory, typically, you will not truncate.
Yes. Yeah, but for like, if you have... So in this case, I'm first assuming that there is that the operators that I'm talking about are just double trace, and they are this kind of operator that I showed you before. Otherwise, you need to have maybe another parameters, and these other parameters will reproduce some...
Because in
particular,
the statement is only true at the linear order 1 over n.
Yeah, this is true, only third order 1 over n squared.
If you go to the next order, you'll find that these coefficients are non-zero for all spins.
Yeah, this is actually what happens at order 1 over n to the 4, that these coefficients are non-zero for all spins.
But I guess And if you make this solution, so this solution has a finite range of spin, but you can kind of have the limit of this solution, which the range of spin becomes infinite. Like you can have the solution for like a this.
Yeah, but then if you resum, you can have this kind, you can try to resum, but then you get that the sum has a different behavior with the spin, which is something that is never allowed in this kind. Yes, but it should be finite. Yeah.
Okay, another question.
Sure.
So in here, like you have an infinite sum of n, right? Even
yes.
The spin is kind of has a couple, and the sum of n is infinite.
The sum of n is infinite, yes.
Is there a simple way to see that you do not get any additional dots from the sum of n?
That you don't get some log square b? I think you need to do the computation. This is actually what we did for the other example. You need to just do that. The point is that n appears also here, so there is so the point is that so if you remember this, so the log v comes essentially when you take the small v limit, and the small v limit is related to the I large spin expansion. Instead, the large n is controlled also by this power of u, and then I think you just need to check and do exactly that you don't get any enhanced divergence, and this is actually what happens. So you, the range of n is infinite, because with that you don't get any higher divergence.
Sorry, can I ask again? So what's the physical interpretation of the fact that you need a finite number? Because to me it looks very counterintuitive that I cannot put inside ADS any spin I want. What's the physics of this finite that's in capital letters?
So the fact that you have a finite number of spin is the fact that you essentially have a mapping between all the exchange diagram in ADS. So you can have all the exchange like phi to the 4, delta phi to the 4, and so on. These are all related to some finite set of this gamma NL being different from 0. So I mean that, for instance, for phi to the 4, the only allowed intermediate operator is the operator in 0. Then if you go to delta phi to the 4, the only allowed exchange operators are spin 0 and 2, and so on. So there is a one-to-one mapping between so you should have a contact interaction. So all of them are contact interaction. Of course, for instance, if you have exchange of this form, you can have infinite many spins.
So you say it's
but this is if you need to have you need to allow yourself to have the operator O itself in the OP. I'm not allowing this operator.
So you say that you don't have a contact interaction.
So I'm saying that if you have this
contact.
So if you have this kind of like phi, 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 or all the derivatives, this only contribute to a finite number of this gamma being different from 0. But as soon as you have this kind of object here, then you have infinitely many that contribute. So if you have this kind of exchange which are not contact. Okay. Now you can see that in a Mellin representation, and essentially the Mellin representation has a big advantage, and the big advantage is the fact that crossing symmetry is manifest. So by construction, you can impose that your amplitude is crossing symmetric. And another nice point is that that the analytic properties of Mellin amplitudes, meaning residues and poles, are related to the CFT data. For instance, if we write this kind of Mellin amplitude, that I just, so this has a, you can define it with some shifts, but let's fix the notation to be in this way. So the parameter here are S and T, and this U hat is for delta minus S minus T. As you see, this part here is already symmetric in ST and U hat. And then crossing symmetry is equivalent to say that MSMT has to be equal to MSU hat and MPS. So this, as I said, this you can just implement the crossing symmetry at the level of the Mellin amplitude. Now we will see how this is related to the OPE data. Then the amplitude has poles. For instance, if we take the T channel, we can take also the S and U hat, whatever we want, and the amplitude has poles in T at the twist delta P minus LP for this kind of exchange operators, and the residues of this pole here encode the OP coefficient of this kind of exchange. So we can see this from here. As I said, there is a pole at this position, and this is nothing but the residue. These polynomials QLN are Mach polynomials, and they are closely related to the Mellin transform of conformal blocks. And they satisfy orthogonality relations, which are known explicitly only for n equal to 0. But we believe that they are true also. There are also some orthogonality relations for n different from 0, even if they are not, explicit. Okay, so let me do the same thing that I said before at 3 level in this language. And as you can see from here, the exchange of double trace operator is already encoded in these gamma functions. So as I said before, since we don't allow this kind of exchange because we said that there are no single trace operator in the OP, then the Mellin amplitude doesn't have any pole because all the poles are taken into account by the gamma functions. And then in this setup, the Mellin transform is just a polynomial. So at order 1 over n squared, this Mellin amplitude is just a polynomial of some order, for instance, in S, and in S and T, actually. And it is possible to write, by using the orthogonality properties of the Mach polynomials, an integral equation for gamma 0 L1. So this is gamma 0 L1, and we can compute by putting some M3, we can compute the anomalous dimension. And so for this at 3 level, which is 1 over n squared, because these are 3 level diagrams, we are able to compute gamma 0 L from this formula here. And from the CFT, I already explained how to compute. Essentially, I didn't really explain, but I told you that you can compute gamma NL and ANL. OK, let's move. There is something. So there can be, of course, I specified at the beginning that we can compute the polar part of the amplitude. So in principle, there can be regular terms. But for the moment, I'm going to ignore any kind of regular term that can appear in here. Because of course, regular term, they will just change the residue. So they won't modify the polar structure. So they will, again, be consistent with crossing, but they will modify the three-point couplings. But I'm going to ignore for the moment the regular terms. So for the case of, for instance, of phi to the 4, Mellin amplitude is a constant, and we will have the gamma 0n is different from 0, and a0n is different from 0, so only spin 0 operators are exchanged, and all the rest are 0. Okay, let's move on. So now we would like to see if we can say something about this object here, gamma 2, and eventually also a2. Let's again go back to the expansion. So we have now this kind of expansion. This is nothing but, again, you plug the expansion of delta and A, and you get this kind of expansion. So as you see, this looks very familiar because this is exactly as what we have before. And it is the only difference is that instead of having A1 and gamma 1, we have A2 and gamma 2. And notice that this is the only part in which A2 and gamma 2 appear. So in this last two lines, there is no A2, gamma 2. That's only they appear all in this first line. Now, as you can see, there is also a term which is log square u because we are expanding twice. So when we take the derivative of u to the delta, we get a log square u. And so we have this term here. Now, this term, of course, has to correspond through crossing to a term which is of like log square v, and this term can be obtained by summing an infinite number of conformal blocks for each twist. So we fix n, with twist I mean n, little n, and then this can be reproduced only by summing over an infinite number of spin. And this will be more clear in a second, but that's just to give an upshot on what's going to happen. Now, let's look more carefully to the term which contains log square u. These terms, so you can see here, there is a double sum over n and l. And if we just look at the term proportional to log square u, you can see that there is a zero gamma one square, and then the conformal block. Notice that since we start with a solution at order 1 over n squared, which is truncated in the spin, this sum over L is not an infinite sum, but is truncated to a sum spin L, which is the spin of the solution at order 1 over n squared. But this L is a finite number. The only sum which is infinite is this sum over N. Then, so this is a finite number in L, and then as we expected, we get only a log v from this kind of expansion, because this is just a finite number of conformal blocks. And we decide to write this sum in this way. So we take this factor u to the delta out, and then we have a function f u and v, some log v plus g u v, and this function are regular in the logs. And notice a very nice part of the story is that this f of u and v and g u v, they depend only on leading order CFT data, meaning they only depend on a0 gamma 1 square. So in principle, since we know the order 1 over n square, we can compute these functions f u v and g u v, or at least we are able to write them as an infinite sum over n. That's pretty nice, because we will see that this allows us to compute the gamma 2, actually. Then remember that we have crossing symmetry. So since we can rewrite crossing symmetry at this order in this way, and then since we have this log square u here, so this is just a component proportional to log square u, there should also be a term of this form. So we are using essentially this equation here, which contains a log square v. Now, the idea is to understand from which kind of term in the conformal partial wave decomposition this log square v can appear. So from which term of the decomposition that I showed you a couple of slides ago can come. So again, I just copied the expansion of a couple of slides before. As I said, these two lines don't have any log square v, and they cannot have any log square v because the sum over spin is truncated. So the only thing that we can have is a log v. But a log square v can come in this infinite sum here. And this is actually what happens. Then if we focus on the log square v part, we see that this kind of sum, which is the sum that I underlined with red, it has to be equal to fvu, and where fvu is just the crossed part of this object here. Then you can see that this is pretty nice, because this provides us an equation for gamma nl2. So through this equation, somehow we have, remember again that FVU is completely computable by knowing the 1 over n square CFT data. So this does not depend on any A2 or gamma 2. So this is just an equation for gamma 2. Of course, it's not easy to solve, because this is a sum which is infinite both in n and l. OK, let me show you how to try to solve this kind of equation. Again, let's focus on this sum here, on the part which goes like log square v. I repeat again that in order to obtain this log square v, we need to have an infinite sum over L, and actually the log square v contribution comes from the tail of large spin. And if we allow the large spin expansion of gamma 2 to be of this form, so this is some coefficient which is known over L to the 2 delta, where delta again is the dimension of the external operator, then we have this kind of expansion. And I will show you in a couple of slides that actually all these coefficients are computable. So of course, this is an infinite sum, and all these b's are computable, and I will show you how to compute them. And maybe five slides, I will also show you how to compute the whole sum, how to resum all these large spin expansion for the case, for instance, of 5 to the 4, like, let's say, some kind of interaction like that. Of course, this is the 1 over n square, so we are going to talk about the next one. Okay, let me summarize in one slide. What I discussed up to now, I discussed how to find all the contribution which are proportional to log square u, and the contribution coming from log square u are all coming from gamma 1 square a 0. And they can be written in this form, and this contains a function, and this function is fully determined by a 0 and gamma 1 that we know from previous order. Then, through crossing, we identify an equation for gamma 2, which is this one, and this equation admits a solution of this form. Now, what I'm going to discuss, a method to solve this equation. And in order to do so, I will just find the contribution for n equal to 0, which is due to a single conformal block in this kind of sum. Then I will specify a solution of order 1 over n squared, because as I said, everything, so this f of u v, the term is completely fixed, but as soon as we fix a solution at order 1 over n squared, so I need to specify a solution. And then I will sum over little n, which means that I will sum over all the blocks. Okay, so let me say some technicalities. So when we expand for small u, the conformal blocks takes this form, where these collinear blocks are just these functions g0 here. So it's just the first contribution to this expansion. Then, just to remind you that the collinear blocks, the full conformal blocks are the eigenfunction of the quadratic Casimir, and also the collinear blocks are eigenfunction of another operator, which is very closely related to the quadratic Casimir. And we can write this equation here, where j square, so this c is a differential operator, and this j square is given by this relation here. Okay, now in the small v limit, again, we can write this relation here. The idea is to apply this differential operator, C, to both sides of this equation. And then by this, the action of C on the right-hand side will produce, will increase the divergence. And then we can explore more and more terms on this side of the expansion, meaning that we can essentially probe each time that we apply the Casimir, we can probe one coefficient more in this expansion here. Okay, notice that by acting a finite number of times with the operator C on this kind of object produce a negative power of V. This doesn't happen if we have a log V. And this is very much related to your question, because you need to act with a finite number of times on this object in order to get a negative power of V. And this negative power of V is what fixes the whole large spin expansion of the anomalous dimension. Okay, so let's start by considering this sum. Actually, since I choose a four-point function with identical operator, I restrict to this sum where L is even, and I'm considering scalar operators. In this kind of sum, there is no insertion of any gamma, so it's just a zero G2, and this just gives 1 over V to the gamma. Now we can consider insertion of this type, because these are the kind of sums that we are going to face, because these are the kind of coefficient that we are going to get. And we can write this object in this way, where this HN of B is just the action of the Casimir on the right-hand side of the equation before. Then we assume an expansion of gamma 0 to that now it can be written in terms of this J, which is the eigenvalue of this quadratic differential operator. And this can be written in this form. Now we can rephrase the problem in this way. So we can say that we can write f of v like in a kind of expansion of where this function h are just an expansion in a basis, essentially. So if we are able to write all this b0, b1, b2, and so on, we are able to write the f of v, essentially. Now we have a recurrence relation for this function h. And for integer delta, we have also this extra relation. In general, finding the basis for in this kind of language is pretty complicated. So if we choose any kind of dimension or any kind of meaning the external dimension, it's pretty complicated. But actually, in this case, there is a way out. And the way out is to do a change of coordinates and reformulate the problem in this kind of coordinates. And for delta, where delta, again, is the dimension of the external operator, we can write, we can find the solution. And the solution, quite remarkably, can be written in terms of harmonic polylogs, where harmonic polylogs are just defined here in this form. And these are just combination of harmonic polylogs, but the most nice part of this expansion is that it is just a finite. There, it contains a finite number of terms. This is very nice because we started with an infinite, with an expansion in infinite many terms, and now we have been able to rewrite this as a finite number of terms. So then this actually gives an hope to be able to solve this equation, and actually this can be done in a kind of systematic way, and we can get essentially all the coefficients here. And so, yeah, we can write essentially the basis of solution by doing this kind of identification. And this procedure can be used to essentially compute all the coefficients, as I told you before. So this kind of C is here. Again, let me just say how we did it. We find the term proportional to this log v, for each block, which I called fns. Then we compute all the coefficients in the large spin expansion for the anomalous dimension. This is for each conformal block. Now we need to sum for all conformal block. And this is essentially, I think I wrote it here. So in order to do that, we need to perform essentially this kind of sum. Let me go back. And let's study one example, which is the easiest one. The easiest one is that when we fix the solution at order 1 over n squared to b phi to the 4. And we decide to study the case of delta equal to 2. So we choose the dimension of the external operator to be 2. And we focus on dimension 2 and 4. This is just because in 2 and 4 dimensions, the conformal blocks are known in a closed form. So it's a bit slightly easier to do this procedure. But it can be done in any dimension, space-time dimension, and for any integer delta. Now, in this case, the relevant conformal block is the spin 0, because as I said, to phi to the 4 at order 1 over n squared, there is only the exchange of spin 0. And we can find essentially this contribution of gamma hat for any n. And I specify that for the s equal to 0 case, because as I said, there is only intermediate operator of spin 0. And this can be written in this very nice form. So this is a polynomial in n of degree 2 plus 2n. This is a polynomial in n of degree 2n, where we know essentially all the coefficients of this polynomial. And this is just the psi function of L plus 1. So the dependence of n is only in the degree of this polynomial, and the power of this j here. In d equal 4 is essentially the same story. I didn't write it there, but the only thing that changes is the power here. So we will have a slightly different power and, of course, different coefficients, but is it essentially possible to write that in the same way? Okay. Then we can essentially perform this sum, which will give us the gamma 0 L at order 1 over n to the 4. I reported here the solution that we got in dimension 2 and dimension 4. And you can see easily from here that this full, the full large spin expansion can be resummed and gives exactly this contribution here. And here I put, so 0, 2, 4 is the spin of the intermediate operator. This is in two dimension, this is in four dimension. You can see, okay, you get some numbers. This alpha is nothing but the gamma 0, 0 at order. So this is just a normalization that you can choose as you like. We decide to fix this gamma 0, 0, 1. And we got this number here. Notice that gamma 0, 0, 2 is divergent. And this is pretty expected because not from the CFT point of view, I think. But if we look to the ADS5 at order 1 over n squared, it requires some counterterm in order to fix this divergence. So we expect this object to be divergent. So kind of a phi to the 4 counterterm. Instead, for the ADS3, we don't need any such counterterm. So we expect the result to be finite, and that's what we got. OK, for the moment, you can just forget about this. But notice that just we have some numbers. And now let me go to the Mellin approach. Again, actually, the Mellin side is pretty similar to the CFT in the sense, first of all, OK, let me remind that since we don't have single trace operator in the OP, we can write the full Mellin amplitude just by looking to the one loop of the double trace operators, so where this object here means for only the double trace operator of this form are included. And then again, we will see in a second that all the poles and residues of the amplitude, of the one loop amplitude, are completely fixed by the result at order 1 over n squared. So I think it's essentially the same that we have for the CFT case. Again, the log square u is fully fixed. So you see essentially that the coefficient in front of log u is the same because this is nothing but the conformal partial wave expansion. These two guys can be computed at order 1 over n squared. And now we know we want to reproduce each power of u, and we see that in order for in order to have this kind of object here, we need to have simple poles for the one loop amplitude. Why do we need to have so? Because remember, before we had some gamma function squared, this was we're reproducing a log u. Now, in order to get a log square u, we need to have a pole. And when we take the residue of the pole, this will generate a log square u. That's why we need to have a pole in the anomalous, sorry, in the Mellin amplitude. So M one loop should acquire a simple pole, and the residues are all fixed by gamma 1.
Sorry, I'm a bit off. Sure. Now we are just redoing what you just did in Mellin.
Exactly. Yes.
Why? We already did it. I'm a bit confused. Why are we doing this now?
So we are doing this because we would like to compute the Mellin amplitude in this case. If we want to compute, let's say, M one loop of S and T. In principle, actually, they can be, these objects also can be different.
Here you will not have, you will only have access to this polar part stuff.
Exactly. This is only the polar part, again. And it will be pretty nice because at the end we exactly find the same kind of solution in both ways. So somehow, by choosing the solution before, you already say that the regular terms in this case are just zero. The point is that, so there is one crucial point, that in everything that I explained in the CFT, we did something which is a bit tricky in the sense that we have resummed and spin, a large spin expansion. But in general, we didn't check explicitly that this solution was, for instance, crossing symmetric. It may be that when you resum, this is, may not be crossing symmetric, and there may be terms which are not fully Correct. So this is essentially a check of the CFT result. And it's also a check of the it's also a method of computing the one loop amplitude. Because you just, in order to construct the one loop amplitude, you only need the CFT data order 1 over n squared. OK, so this is essentially the whole the structure of the amplitude. Again, in this case, there should be a pole, differently from the 1 over n squared case. This function cannot be fixed by three-level data, because there is always the freedom of having a regular term, plus all the cross terms. OK, let's come back again to our easy example, phi to the 4. In phi to the 4, we get that the one loop amplitude it can be written in this way, where these rn are just constant. And yeah, you can just essentially have this kind of expansion. And from this kind of one loop amplitude, we can compute the anomalous dimension, gamma 0 l, where this m prime is the one loop amplitude minus the pole in this t equal to 2 delta. Now we can compute this gamma 2 by using the one loop amplitude given in this equation here. And in order to compute this integral, as you can easily imagine, this m one loop is an infinite sum over n, so this sum needs to be regularized, because if you look at it just trivially, this sum is divergent. Then we just regularize by using a zeta function regularization. And we computed again gamma 0,2, gamma 0,4, and gamma 0,0 in two dimensions. And actually, quite nicely, this result, they agree with the CFT results. So you can compute this object here using this formula, and you just get the results of the CFT. Sure. Yeah, also here. Yeah, yeah, this is exactly, so the result that I'm showing, these numbers that I put here, these are for delta equal 2. I wrote somewhere this. Yeah, for delta equal 2. But actually, if you want, in my computer, I have it for delta 3 and 4, I think. In the Mellin approach, I don't think there is any I think in the Mellin approach you can do whatever you like, but in the CFT you cannot. That's why we pick up some integer delta. Okay, so again, let me just comment on the divergence. So as I said, we expect this kind of divergence. This is a UV divergence, and this is due to the fact that ADS5 requires a counterterm of this form, while ADS3 does not. And this is explicit, as I said, in the fact that we get only the divergent for spin 0, essentially. Okay, well, let me just conclude by saying what we have learned, and I will also mention what I didn't show in this talk, but we figured it out. So this, I just explained how to use the analytic bootstrap approach to find solution of crossing equation at order 1 over n to the 4, and I explained a bit the method that we use, that we were able to resum the full expansion for large spin up to finite spin. And then we computed the anomalous dimension for several cases, also for small values of the spin as spin 0 and 2, so very low values of the spin. And on the other hand, we computed the polar part of the Mellin amplitude. And we computed the anomalous dimension associated to this amplitude. And we found agreement between these two methods. So what I didn't show you, it was other examples that we computed, so some other kind of interaction that we computed, but essentially it's more everything boiled back to this kind of examples. And another thing that I didn't show is the fact that we have been able to compute one part of the amplitude also when there is in the theories like phi cube, for instance, in which you have an exchange of this kind, and we were able to compute only one part of the amplitude, which is essentially the triangular diagram. But it's essentially the same procedure. I just decided to present the phi to the 4 because it's the easiest one to do and to understand. What we didn't do at all, so as you can see, I show you how to compute the gamma 2 only for n equal to 0. And since, so in the CFT side, this can be done for any n. So we can compute in the CFT gamma 2 for any little n. But in the Mellin approach, it's pretty complicated, and actually we don't know how to do that. Because the problem is, again, the fact that there is no explicit orthogonality relation for the Mach polynomial for n greater than 0. So it's a bit complicated, and we tried a bit, but we didn't succeed. But it may be that it is possible to write an equation of this form also for gamma nl. And I think this, maybe I put it also in the open problems. No, but this may be an open problem to study higher ends. And we tried a bit, as I said, but we didn't push much. So some open problems. One, of course, I think is one of the most interesting, is to put the stress tensor again, so allowing with stress tensor, actually, I mean any single trace operator of twist 2 as the stress tensor. And actually, we are in progress, so this we have been able to find the solution at order 1 over n squared for the moment. And it's a bit complicated, but can be done. Another thing is to try to apply this method to supersymmetric field theories. This, in principle, can be done. I put a yes slash no. But the no is just because there is degeneracy. So this cannot be done explicitly for any gamma. But this is, we can get results for the average, so for the product of A0 gamma. But OK, this may be a problem or not. The other thing is that we need to work with super conformal blocks in order to get, I think, the best result, and especially for supersymmetric theories like 2,0 theories and so on. This may be a bit complicated, but for the it should be more or less the same kind of procedure that we had. Another thing is to do that for higher orders in 1 over n. And this also can be done, but now there is a caveat, because when you go, for instance, at order 1 over n to the 6, there are also higher trace operators appearing. And this higher trace operator appearing will appear with a coefficient. And this coefficient is free, because it appears the first time that it appears is at that order. Then we will have some free parameters, which are more than what we should have in principle. But I'm sure that something can be said also in this case, maybe not for the full amplitude, but for part of the amplitude. But we didn't study this case. OK, that was everything. Thank you.
When the small n goes to become very large, how do various quantities behave?
So that's a very good question. Actually, it's not clear how they behave, but actually should be related to. So when we say large spin expansion, what we are saying is that we take this J square to be very large, but J square can be large. So let me go back to the definition. It can be large also because delta is large, where delta is related to little n. So there should be some interesting thing that can be said also for little n large, which should again be J square being large. But I don't know how it is.
Because you had some different intuition that summing over infinite spins can be large, but summing over infinite time can also. What is it? Physically, large spin, they are rotating fast, and large n is.
Large n is big operators, like large operators. So, like you are focusing the center on the largest twist if you take the small little n. Something that can be done, and I think some people have done, like Sinha and his group, they did both large little n and large spin together. Because then you can do some things. And for today, I think they found the leading order. They fixed the leading order behavior. And also maybe some of the extra guys. So also this is fixed. But yeah, this is a very good point, actually.
So higher loops,
So you get something more if you consider at the same time, for example, five-point function. Because if you consider a five-point function, then already at the tree-level diagonal, you can get frequent rates.
Yeah, I think again, also in five-point functions, you have some three parameters. And they should be related, yes. Yeah. I think one can do either five. The point is that not many, so the structure of five-point function is a bit more delicate because you have more ways of taking the OPEs. So you have essentially crossing plus another equation. They may be a bit more hard, but this may also be helpful. Like you take 1 over n to the 6, let's say, and you consider also five-point function. Another thing that one can do, for instance, is to study mixed four-point function. When I say mixed, meaning not all operator with the same dimension, but different dimension. And this may also give extra constraints on different, what I mean is that if you go to order 1 over n to the 6, for instance, they give different, so one would be c squared and the other would be c times c, because you imagine if you take pairs equal in pairs, so you have different kind of relations. This, for instance, when you have degeneracy can be lifted by using this kind of correlator. But yeah, one can also study five-point function, like studying the whole, but yeah, we didn't do anything for this. So I cannot really say some facts, just some ideas.
So there are kind of quick ways to estimate in which range of speed you get diverging encounters. Because I guess in the bulk, it's probably not so hard to estimate in which range of speed you get diverging encounters. But I was wondering if it's possible to estimate
Yes, it is also possible to estimate that. You need to go to some range. So the large spin is related by 1 over square root of v. So that's essentially the kind of, when there is a divergence in 1 over square root of v, that's where you get the contribution. Because you can rewrite 1 over l. And I think that's just when it's fully infinite, just the tail of infinite spin. If you have any finite spin, this won't produce any extra divergence. You need to go exactly to the v0 limit when you have 1 over square root of v, and this should give the divergence. This is what Sasha and Zohar did in their paper. And so there is not really a range of spins. Like if you take any finite range,
That's
very simple. So you go to the, when you need a counter term of phi to the 4, you get only spin 0. If you need a counter term of the way in which you can see from the CFT is also pretty easy. And this is the dependence with n of this object here. I wrote you some polynomials at some point. P of something. Okay. So if you compute the large n behavior of this P, you see when they are going to diverge. Because, so this is gamma hat. A0, you know how it is. So A0 times gamma should, if this is... generates a divergent, you easily see by looking at the large little n going to 0 in this side of the equation. And then you see where, so this of course depends, as I said, depend on the spin. So you fix the spin to be 0, 2, and so on. And then you see when this gamma 0 times A diverges, and then you say, okay, that's a divergence there. And we have a formula in our paper where that tells exactly where the divergence is going to be. And it should map, as you said, this kind of divergence in the bytes that you, like counter terms, like the phi to the 4 and so on. And you can see by looking at the divergence for large n here. Fixing L, you look to the large n.
There's no microphone left, please.